Welcome to Behind the Headlines from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW. This is our Friday morning news roundup, and it's heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, following a public repeal effort, Governor Gary Herbert and the legislature announced that they'll undo the tax reform they passed in last month's special session. Also, Utah becomes the 19th state in the nation to ban so-called conversion therapy. And Shad Reyes joins fellow Republican attorneys general to urge the acquittal of President Donald Trump in his Senate impeachment trial. And joining me for this conversation, Salt Lake Tribune Washington Bureau Chief Thomas Burr. Hi, Tommy. Thanks for being here on the phone.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning. We've also got reporter Bethany Rogers. Welcome to you, Bethany. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And editorial page editor and columnist George Pyle. Hi, George, and good morning.
Good morning.
Listeners, you are invited to join this discussion with your questions and comments. The number to call is 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. You can also tweet to us. Our handle is at KCPW. Thomas Burr joining us from the Senate Gallery in the U.S. Capitol. We've got you for just the first part of the show before you head to a press conference. You have been following the Senate impeachment trial of President Donald Trump. Impeachment managers have been making a methodical case in their opening arguments for what they say the president did wrong, and we are entering day three of those opening arguments. Instead of asking you to summarize what's being said in those arguments, Tommy, can I ask you to tell us, you know, what you're paying attention to as you watch all of this? What's the scene in the Senate as all of this is playing out?
Well, first off, thank you for not making me summarize 24 hours of opening arguments, because that would take a little while to get through that. You know, it's an interesting setting. I've covered the Senate for, 15 years now, and it's a weird vibe because, you know, it's not the usual how the Senate is running. The reporters are very restricted on where we can go and what we can do. You know, I've been watching from inside the Senate in the gallery, in the seats, where I've been literally taking a pad of paper and a pen, and that's it. No phones, no laptops, not even smartwatches are allowed in there. But it's been kind of fun. My first thing I think I do is when I get in there, I look for, you know, Senators Romney and Lee and see if I can see them. That I want to make sure that no senators are sleeping. And then, like, the third thing I do is I look for Alyssa Milano. It's like, find Alyssa Milano. It's the goal.
That's funny. You know, we've seen, you know, this case made over the past couple of days over the abuse of power and obstructing Congress. That's what the president is being accused of pressuring Ukraine for his own personal political gain while hurting the national interest. And then also part of this has to do with preventing records and testimony from being released. Today is the third and final day of the Democrats' opening arguments. What's going to happen today, Tommy?
So we're going to look at, I guess, the House managers, which is essentially the prosecution team of the impeachment trial, are going to lay out essentially their case on the president obstructing Congress. So the last couple of days we've heard the charge of abuse of power and what the president did with Ukraine. Today we're switching over to the fact the president warned and demanded that none of his administration officials testify. No one from the White House has testified. He's ordered the White House not to agree to give any documents. State Department and DOD also warned against giving any documents to the House as part of the impeachment inquiry, which is where we get this obstruction of Congress charge. So we're going to hear these House managers go back and forth. And just kind of go through the schedule. We're all just kind of, you know, penciling this in right now. We're not really sure how it's going to go, but the White House team, the president's defense attorneys, essentially will get a chance to start tomorrow on Saturday. With their opening arguments, we don't think they're going to go as long as the House managers have, maybe a couple days. Let's put this kind of midweek, early next week. We're going to hear questions from senators submitted through the Chief Justice, John Roberts. And then we'll probably have some votes on whether to allow witnesses. If there are no witnesses, we could see this wrapped up by, you know, next Saturday or maybe the Monday after that, and have a vote.
On the question of witnesses, I mean, that was pretty central to... you know, as we thought about when we spoke last, you and I on the show, actually, we talked about the question of witness and how central that was to leading into the impeachment trial. Are witnesses going to be called at some point, or do we have any bead on that, Tommy?
The question is whether four Republicans will agree to want witnesses. So right now, of course, there's 53 Republicans, there are 47 Democrats or independents in the caucus with the Democrats. So they need four votes. To make a majority to allow witnesses to come in. Senator Romney, Utah, of course, is already on record saying that he would like to hear John Bolton, maybe others testify before the Senate, or at least in a closed session or a deposition of some sort. But whether Romney and three others will vote that way is still a big question mark. If witnesses are allowed, that could really change the dynamic of this trial right now, which is at the moment very much looking like the president will be acquitted on a party line vote in a week or so.
Okay. I want to turn to some related news that you covered this last week before we have to let you go, Tommy, and that's that the Utah's Attorney General, Sean Reyes, is joining up with a bunch of other Republican AGs with a sort of legal brief or semi-legal brief, and it's a brief in support of the president's defense. Can you explain what this is, Tommy?
Yeah, sure. In a normal legal setting, if this is a court trial, for example, you would get an amicus brief. You'd have a friend of the court brief that people could file to say, this is our opinion on how this this case should go. In this instance, Sean Reyes and 20 other attorneys general across the United States, all Republican, did a friend of the Senate legal brief that they sent. And it's essentially saying, this is a kangaroo court, that there's no evidence, it should never have gone this far, this is just, the Democrats on a witch hunt against the president. And this is shocking. Of course, Republicans have been sticking up for their own along the way, as Democrats have been, arguing the case against the president. It was interesting to note, as my editor pointed out, in looking at the election filings, that the Republican Attorneys General Association, which kind of organized this friend of the Senate brief, gave Sean Reyes $125,000 about 10 days ago.
Okay, so that's interesting. That is interesting. Did all of the Republican state attorneys general, well, I guess there's two questions there. One is, did all of the Republican state attorneys general get a donation from this organization? And then did they all also sign on to this organization's letter?
I don't know if they all got donations. I actually haven't checked that. But there were 26 Republicans as attorneys general across the United States, and only 21 signed a letter. I didn't actually look and see which states they were, but I'm going to guess they are more of a purple state than the deep red state of Utah.
Okay. And again, this basically falls in line with the president's common defense, which is that all of this is a sham. Did you speak to Reyes and get further rationale for his filing this friend of the court brief on behalf of the president?
I did not speak to Reyes, but he was not part of the news conference here just outside the Senate. But he was not present for that. But it was the same argument that other Republicans are making. And let's just point that out for a second. This is nothing has really changed since the start of the trial, but everyone seems in lockstep now as they were the second the senators walked in to the chamber. And it's been interesting to see how, Republicans are, trying to pay attention to some point, but, some of them are getting a little tired. There was some senator with a fidget spinner yesterday just trying to keep awake, and they're drinking water and milk to hydrate themselves, I guess, to listen to all these arguments. And the next question I think we're going to find is whether the president, who has said, I think, twice now that he would like to come watch the trial, whether he'll actually make an appearance in the next few days as his team gives his defense.
Tommy, I'm going to have you hold on for just a second while I turn to George Pyle, editorial page editor and columnist. And George, actually don't know what to ask you. The impeachment, corruption, there's been, partisanship sort of shown in these proceedings from the get-go, the kitchen sink of questions here. Where do you want to dive in as editorial page editor and columnist?
Well, I think it's interesting that the conservative pundit class basically has given up on the Republican Party. I mean, people like Jennifer Rubin and Max Boot are saying, I'm never voting for another Republican again as long as I live, or I'm certainly not voting for any in this next election. They need to be punished. They need to be brought down for their lockstep worshipfulness of this president, who is neither really a Republican nor a conservative. And the fact that they're doing their, when he says jump, they say how high, is just a shame. It's just a very black mark on this party. And if we had real democracy in this country, if we had real political activism in this country, the Republican Party would now die. And it would be replaced by a true center-right, Mitt Romney, Mike Leavitt, kind of Republican Party that the country can really use and right now doesn't have.
George Pyle, opinion maker in residence here at the radio station on the show. And George, what about the argument that's basically, well, I don't know. We'll see what the opening arguments from the Republicans look like, or from the president's defense team looks like. But just the idea that this is all baked up to further, you know, to try and help Democrats win the election and so on and so forth.
Well, that's a side benefit of it. If you're a Democrat, if you're a Democrat Party activist, and that you're, of course, you're hoping that this makes the president look bad, this makes the Republicans look bad, this helps Democrats in November. But at the same time, I mean, when these guys get up and start delivering their case, every indication we have is they have no case. And they will basically admit that by saying that it doesn't matter what the president did, because he's president and he can do anything he wants. And you guys are Democrats, therefore whatever you say can't be believed or can't be trusted. So you should acquit the president, because you'd be, you know, undoing the results of an election. Undoing the results of an election is why impeachment is in the Constitution, because the founders didn't totally trust elections and didn't totally trust voters or even members of the Electoral College not to make a mistake. People make mistakes. And they need sometimes to be undone. Plus, you know, if you're really worried about the results of the election, the popular vote, Hillary Clinton won that election. It's only because of the original affirmative action that's baked into the Constitution that rural states get way more influence in the Senate and in the Electoral College than they deserve.
Hmm. Tommy Burr, there in Washington, D.C., I want to turn back to you in the Senate gallery, in fact. Before we let you go, we haven't asked for an update on how Utah's senators are comporting themselves as impeachment plays out and what we might expect from Senators Lee and Romney as this moves forward, aside from, you know, the vote on whether or not to allow witnesses. You know, are you watching them as they're there on the floor, and what are they doing?
Yeah, sure, and I think we know exactly where they stand at the moment. So Senator Lee has been very upfront about the idea that he is going into this knowing that he, you know, this is a sham trial. He doesn't believe that the president should have been impeached in the first place, that the Democrats have no case, that it shouldn't even got to this point. He's going to a news conference, which I'm going to run to in about 5 minutes, his thoughts on this. He's not coming as an open mind, which is what Senator Romney has said he's doing, that he's listening to all the testimony, all the opening arguments, reading all the testimony from before and then listening to the opening arguments. Mm-hmm. And he does believe he wants to hear from John Bolton and perhaps others. So we're going to see a vote early next week on whether to allow witnesses. And like I said before, I assume Romney will stick to his word and actually vote to have witnesses. But at the end of the day, it's highly unlikely from anyone I've talked to that Mitt Romney is going to break ranks and vote to remove the president. So it's probably a good bet, if you want to make one in Vegas right now, that Romney and Lee are going to vote to acquit.
But the odds would better favor you the other way around if you wanted to win a bunch of money. Tommy Burr,
yeah.
There's a distinction though between. You know, between the two senators and their positions, like, as you pointed out, that Romney is going in not, you know, believing that the whole process itself is this quote-unquote sham, whereas Senator Lee is Romney an outlier, I mean, in the entirety of the Republican Party on this? I guess I think we kind of all know the answer to that, but go ahead and answer it.
No, you're fine. I think it is a good question, because they're about three or four senators that everyone's kind of eyeing right now, three or four Republican senators that could be, you know, on the bubble a little bit. So we have, Mitt Romney, who said he's keeping an open mind. He wants to be impartial. He's never not a huge fan of the president, necessarily. There's Susan Collins of Maine, who's, you know, a little bit underwater in the polling up there, and, you know, maybe one of those votes that could be four witnesses. So Lamar Alexander, Tennessee, who's retiring at the end of the year, spent a long time senator, so kind of sees like that, you know, statesman-like role and not being a Trump sycophant. Cory Gardner of next door in there in Colorado, who's, in a state that's turning a little more blue. So you have a few senators that everyone's kind of watching, and Romney is usually right at the top of that.
Okay. Tommy Burr, I know we have to let you go because you are, as you said, heading to a press conference that Senator Lee is holding. So I will allow you to go unless you have any final thoughts before we drop your line here.
I have not seen Alyssa Milano yet, but I will keep an eye out. She's been to every day of the hearings, just sitting in front of her watching. It's been kind of an interesting sidelight to everything going on.
There's you can follow her on Twitter for updates.
and
Tommy Burr as well. Thomas Burr, Washington Bureau Chief with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks very much for taking the time this morning.
Thanks, guys.
Yeah. George Pyle, just before we leave this topic and head on to a break and then come back and cover other news from this past week, you know, you were talking about that the return to the centrism of the Republican Party that you hope to see, and Tommy's talking about Mitt Romney going into the impeachment trial with more of an open mind than someone like Mike Lee, who has said from the outset that this is, you know, a problem process, or that it's a quote-unquote sham. Do you want to just tackle that before we head to a break?
Well, yeah. I mean, Romney has gone into this, and Susan Collins has gone into this, and Lisa Makarowski has gone into this, pledging to keep an open mind and making noises about how, yeah, maybe they need to subpoena documents, maybe they do need to subpoena witnesses, John Bolton particularly. When they had votes earlier this week, they voted with the other Republicans not to call any witnesses, not to call summon any documents. And so all over Twitter, it was, oh, Mitt caved. Where's Mitt's spine? He lost it again. There will be another opportunity, I guess, next week, where they will ask those questions again. Do we want to hear witnesses? Do we want to subpoena more documents? And Mitt could argue that, well, at the beginning of the proceedings, I didn't want to vote that way. I wanted to hear the cases. But after I've heard both cases, then they'll ask us again. Do we want to subpoena John Bolton? Do we want to subpoena various documents? And at that point, it's possible that he and Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski could say, yeah, we want to hear these people. Even if they eventually vote to acquit the president, they at least want to be on the record as saying, we actually left no stone unturned. We brought out the witnesses. We brought out the evidence. And after that happens, then we're willing to stand up and say, look, we did our job, and this is how it came out.
Okay, so a question on process and being able to sort of point to that process. George Pyle, I'm going to stop you there, but there's a lot we could go into here. But we do need to take a quick break on the show. And then when we come back, we will turn to some other news from this past week, including the repeal of a recently passed Utah tax overhaul. This is Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Stay with us.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW, Salt Lake Public Radio, and the Salt Lake Tribune. You can find podcasts of all of our local programs at kcpw.org. And hey, while you're there, why not make a pledge? Because your contributions power this local, independent, nonprofit outlet. Thanks for listening and for supporting public radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I am joined for the remainder of this hour by Salt Lake Tribune reporter Bethany Rogers and editorial page editor and columnist George Pyle. This is our Friday morning news roundup, and you are invited to join us with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-8255. You can also tweet to us. Our handle is at KCPW. Well, Bethany Rogers, just last month, there was a special session of the Utah legislature that enacted a big tax overhaul. And now, during the legislative session that kicks off this month, on Monday, in fact, Utah Governor Gary Herbert and leaders in the legislature say that they will click the undo button. There's more to that story, though, of course. So why is this happening, and how was it announced?
It's happening because the tax bill that they passed in the special session has proven to be extremely unpopular, just kind of across the board. So within days of the passage of this bill, a bipartisan group got together to start a referendum drive in an attempt to put the bill on the ballot this November for a potential repeal. It was kind of a long shot effort. They only had a handful of days, you know, until earlier this week to collect 115,000 signatures from across the state. But they held a press conference earlier this week declaring that they had actually done it. And then some, they said that they had actually collected about 40,000 more signatures than they even needed. The level of support for this referendum effort, I think, was beyond what a lot of people were expecting. And with the entire tax code basically thrown into uncertainty until November with this potential repeal, lawmakers didn't know how they were going to be able to prepare the state budget. They didn't really know how much money was going to be coming in if the tax code is potentially in flux. So rather than just kind of have this cloud hanging over the whole thing, they decided they're going to just repeal it, get rid of it, and pass a clean budget, and then perhaps start from scratch on tax reform later on. The announcement came through yesterday morning, and they said they're going to try to pass this repeal bill within the first week of session.
And so is it that you know, I guess it's probably both things. I was going to ask is it that it was the signature gathering effort and the fact that it looked like it was successful to get that on the ballot, the repeal on the ballot initiative that drove this? Or was it the fact that they couldn't actually prepare a budget not knowing what the future holds when it comes to tax revenue coming in for the state?
I think it was a little bit of both. This statement that they released and the comments that came from the governor yesterday, I think that the budgeting process really added urgency to this because they only have 45 days to get that accomplished. And without knowing, you know, what the state's tax law is, it's really difficult to do that over the time that they have. However, in their statements, they also talked about, you know, going back to the drawing board and trying to regroup and come up with a plan that Utah could be proud of. And they also acknowledged that they had heard people loud and clear, that they had heard the opposition loud and clear. So I think that it was a combination of both.
Part of the reason that lawmakers gave for doing this tax reform in the first place, and we can talk about some of the failed attempts at doing this in the past, or at least one, no, probably two, was that there's this growing structural imbalance in how taxes come in. But the thing that maybe torpedoed this tax reform this time around was the increase to the tax on food. Is that what people who were lining up to sign this repeal initiative were saying was we don't want to see a grocery tax?
Well, so we actually wrote a story about a week ago, my colleague Benjamin Wood, about how this referendum effort kind of brought together people from all different political persuasions. So, I think that for a lot of folks, the food tax was definitely the thing that was most unappealing about the package. But you also had a lot of fiscal conservatives who are just unhappy that there were additional, you know, taxes included in there, and then there weren't also cuts to government spending that came along with it, that there were going to be new services like streaming services or pet boarding or towing that were going to come under the sales tax. And they just didn't like those tax expansions. So I think, you know, the quote from the article was there was something in this package for everyone to hate. So no matter kind of like where you fall on the political spectrum, there was something education advocates didn't like that there were cuts to the income tax the income tax side, which funds public education. So it was just a very sweeping package that touched on a lot of different things. And while I think the food tax was one of the most unpopular ones, I think that there were a lot of different aspects that people took issue with.
In terms of just gathering signatures to get to pressure the legislature and even put the repeal initiative on the ballot, there was a local supermarket chain that got involved that probably played a hand in how many signatures organizers were able to get together, right?
Yeah. So Harmon's opened up their store, their stores around the area to signature gatherers, and also took out ads in support of the tax referendum effort. In an interview that we just did yesterday with Bob Harmon, he said that the food tax was the element that, you know, they had a real problem with it. It was just an extraordinary increase in the food tax. So, I think that was one of the really big drivers for this referendum effort. One of the organizers of the effort said that without Harmon's, a lot of people wouldn't have known where to go to sign one of these petitions. So having their involvement was really important, giving people a physical location to go to.
Will lawmakers try to do something on changing the tax system during this upcoming legislative session? I mean, the plan that they passed is going away, are they going to try and start from scratch but get something done really quickly again?
It seems like the answer is no. Yesterday, during his monthly televised press conference, Governor Gary Herbert said that he really thinks this is something that the next governor should deal with. It seems like he's already been, you know, he's done a couple rounds of this thing, and he kind of indicated that it might be time to take a step back, cool off, give everybody something of a break, that he doesn't think anybody has, you know, really the energy to dive right back into this after really an entire year of intensively looking at tax reform.
George Pyle, I want to bring you in on this in a minute, but first, Bethany, some candidates who are running for governor, to become the next governor, weighed in on what happened in terms of the legislature and the governor announcing this repeal of the tax reform law. What did those candidates for governor say?
So nearly all of the candidates for governor came out in support of the referendum effort. Lieutenant Governor Spencer Cox was unable to because his official job is to supervise the elections office. So it would have been something of a conflict for him to actually take an official position. But he did express that he was opposed to the bill, the underlying bill. So they were all kind of universally pleased that the legislature had rolled this back. One of the candidates, Amy Winder Newton, had a comment. She said that she was pleased that they had made the decision to repeal and they had listened to people, but she said it shouldn't happen with the threat of a referendum hanging over you. So I thought that was a little bit of an interesting jab. And Lieutenant Governor Spencer Cox also weighed in, said that he was happy. And what I took away that was interesting from his comments is that he said he had been behind the scenes kind of sounding the alarm all along, because on the campaign trail, he's heard from so many people who had dire concerns about this tax plan. So he said that he's been trying to persuade lawmakers not to kind of push forward with it. But they did regardless. So he said that there really needs to be a period of really listening to people and taking their feelings about tax reform into consideration before the next round of potential tax reform.
Okay. A reminder to listeners that you can join this conversation by calling 801-355-8255. This is Behind the Headlines, featuring reporters and editors from the Salt Lake Tribune. And you can also tweet to us. Our handle is @KCPW if you have questions or comments on the stories we're covering today. George Pyle, editorial page editor, columnist with the Tribune, the state hitting, you know, the undo button on the tax overhaul. What do you say to that?
Well, I think it's great that this organization got put together, liberals, conservatives, Democrats, Republicans, candidates for office holders, people who have never and will never hold public office, and Harmans. I mean, really, Harmans, I think, probably deserves the Most Valuable Player award in this, because they did not only say, yeah, you can set up your tables here, but their employees would witness signatures. They bought ads. They put up billboards. And they looked at this, and so, you know, for the next week, I have to stop hating corporations because Harmans pushed this through. Our editorial early on was that a task force that had lost sight of its task held a listening tour where nobody listened to pass reforms that weren't reforms. And this is just another example of how completely out of touch legislative leadership is, and to a lesser extent, maybe the governor. Nobody wanted this. Nobody believed this was the way to do it. And even people who accept the premise, which is somewhat weakened by the amount of money that's rolling in from the sales tax already, but who accept the premise that we are shifting from a goods-based economy where everybody buys stuff and you put sales tax on that, to accept food, but you buy cars, you buy toothbrushes, you buy cell phones, it's got sales tax on it. It's the same across the board. As that economy grows, the revenue grows, everybody's happy. Well, we're spending more and more of our money on services,
right,
and that's mostly not taxed, whereas the goods are taxed. And so initially in this process, it was like, well, we're getting out of whack here. The sales tax isn't following the economy. The economy is becoming a service-based economy, especially for jobs. And we're still tied to the goods-based economy.
That's the premise.
And that's the premise. And you can sort of understand that as a theory. But then when they actually came out with the bill, they taxed a few services. They didn't apply it to services across the board. They applied it to services that didn't have good lobbyists at the Capitol. And, you know, so lawyers weren't going to be taxed.
No.
Doctors weren't. I mean, you could say, well, you shouldn't tax medical care. And every service and every good has an argument that we shouldn't be taxed, especially if we haven't been taxed in the past, because it changes the equation for what people do. And the argument that, well, it's okay to tax legal services and landscaping and things like that because rich people buy those things and rich people can afford to pay those taxes. But poor people provide those services. And if they wind up, if their business is hurt, because especially like landscapers and dog groomers and things like that, if they have less business because people don't want to pay the tax, I'm not sure how much, you know, that actually influences people's decisions, but it can, especially with groceries, and that's what hit the chord.
Bethany Rogers, I'm just wondering if anybody that you spoke to or in this debate commented on the idea that, you know, we have these budget surpluses in recent years and, you know, a quote-unquote booming economy, do those facts undermine, you know, the ability of lawmakers to successfully pass a tax reform that sticks. Was there any sort of comment on that from people that you spoke to?
Yeah, a lot of the lawmakers mentioned that it's really hard to convince people that we're heading into a budget crisis when we're posting billion-dollar surpluses. Now, of course, they say that it's, you know, more complicated than that, that the surpluses are restricted funds right. for education. You can't spread it around the budget. But it's a much more complicated message to try to convey, I think. And so it seemed to me that they were frustrated that that they weren't able to just get that message across in a more clear way to the people that they were trying to convince.
Okay.
Well, when they caved on actually applying the sales tax to all services because some of the sectors of the economy were too powerful and they talked them out of it, and they weren't able to come up and say, look, we've applied the sales, and it could even be theoretically the overall rate could go down if it's applied to larger
across
segments of the economy, and we really apply the sales tax to absolutely everything, no matter how powerful your lobbyists are. We could have a lower rate, we could bring in more money, it wouldn't be tied to education, it would go to the general fund, we could leave the income tax alone and have it pay for education, which most people want. When they couldn't get that done, which was their original premise, then the rest of it just fell apart.
Yeah, but who would get reelected, George? I mean, that would take some guts.
But the people who are trying—that's right. But at the same time, the people who are trying to get elected as governor are unanimous in saying this is a bad bill, and it's kind of like what you say, because like Spencer Cox and the others, they're out there and they're listening. They're actually running for office. They're actually out there on the stump, and they don't just talk; they listen. And everybody they hear from says, "We hate this." So, okay, I want to be governor, so I hate it too.
Well, I'm going to use that as a platform to jump into another story altogether having to do with the candidates for governor, because this morning, Bethany Rogers, the Salt Lake Tribune, has a new poll out on that race for the 2020 election to lead the state of Utah. What does that poll, what's the sort of sketch outline of that poll?
The poll asks likely Republican voters who they would support in the primary, who they're leaning towards supporting. And what it showed is that former Governor John Huntsman looks to be slightly ahead of the rest. He's got about a quarter support, 25% of people indicated support for him, with Lieutenant Governor Spencer Cox just slightly behind, 17.5%, and then, you know, the other candidates way behind, former House Speaker Greg Hughes, 6.5%, and everybody else kind of tied at 1%. The biggest group of voters is undecided. It's the 48% of people still don't know who they're going to support in the primary.
Okay, and so that could mean, that could overtake the leaders. If you add that 48% to any individual candidate, yeah, then they would win.
Yeah, basically everybody I talked to yesterday, whether it's candidates or political scientists, says, you know, this poll just shows that the race is still to be determined. There's nothing said about it on any level, that it's really anyone's game at this point. That 48% of voters is going to determine the outcome.
When was this poll conducted?
So the poll was conducted from January 18th to the 22nd, I believe. Yes.
Okay, so recent. And front runners are basically who we probably would have, who you might have assumed they would be. George Pyle, I'm going to turn to you before we head to another break here. A new political poll showing a lot of undecided voters and a couple of front runners. What's your take?
It's interesting. It's early. The undecideds are very high. John Huntsman has huge name recognition already among, you know, there are people out there who are not that politically aware and have never heard of some of these other people. And so they go for the name they recognize. There's also scuttlebutt whether there's any polling behind it or not, that there are also some people who think that the fact that John Huntsman was governor, left, and then came back and wants to be governor again, is, even though it has high name recognition, is going to count against him when it comes to actually voting, because people feel like, well, he left us for a younger woman and now he wants to come back, and that doesn't always work that way.
Bethany, what about Thomas Wright, former Republican Party chair, and his, you know, his running mate, Lieutenant Governor, running mate, who is Representative Rob Bishop? Yeah, and how did they show in this poll?
They were one of the one percenters, and I will note that the poll happened after the announcement that Rob Bishop would be joining the campaign, so it doesn't really appear that it gave him much of a bump.
I never know how to handle polls. They show what they show, and then you talk about, you know, the data around that. On the topic of former Governor Huntsman, what is the Salt Lake Tribune's disclaimer nowadays? Because you have you used to have owner Paul Huntsman, and you're transitioning to nonprofit status.
Yeah, we're transitioning to nonprofit status, so his role is going to change, and I don't even know if he knows exactly what the disclaimer is going to have to be. Okay. Going forward, he remains on the board, and you know.
Well, I just was going to add, we've kept the same editor's note on the bottom of all of our stories.
That is Paul Huntsman, owner,
yes,
publisher.
Yes, and that may change. He as of today, he's still the publisher. He's still on the board of directors. They were telling us we were going to know our board of directors maybe yesterday. Have we seen? I haven't seen that.
We'll keep an eye out.
It's not me.
Okay. All right. You know what? We're going to head to another break here in the show. And when we come back, we've got more news from this past week, including a conversion therapy ban and also our underplayed stories of the week and more. This is Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be back in just a minute.
And again, you're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW Salt Lake Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. Behind the Headlines is just one of our locally produced shows made to inform, engage, and entertain. Go check out our other podcasts and make a pledge at kcpw.org.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I'm joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Bethany Rogers and George Pyle. It's our Friday morning news roundup heard on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Weigh in on what you've been hearing by calling 801-355-8255, or you can tweet to us. Our handle is at KCPW. All right, Bethany, yet another story you wrote this week was the fact that something took effect in Utah this week, something that advocates had long been arguing for, banning a discredited practice. Tell us about the law that took effect and the response in Utah to that having happened.
This is a long-awaited change for LGBTQ advocates, mental health advocates in Utah. It's a ban on so-called conversion therapy when it comes to minors. It's a rule that took effect administratively. It's a professional licensing rule for all therapists, counselors, psychologists. Basically, it makes it an act of unprofessional conduct to try to change the sexual orientation or gender identity of a client who's under the age of 18. And so you could face sanctions from the state, like having your license stripped away from you or paying a fine or being censured if you are found to be guilty of practicing conversion therapy.
This is another instance where something at the legislature was attempted and then stalled, and then tried once again and finally passed. Can you give us a little bit of that history, Bethany? This is something that took some concerted effort to see passed in Utah.
Yeah. So it all began last year. There was a press conference where Equality Utah announced that they had proposed legislation that would ban conversion therapy. They had two Republican lawmakers who were ready to stand up and run it. They had consensus from a lot of the different groups that would be involved, mental health groups and gay advocacy groups. And they also had the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints saying, taking no position on it, so not opposing it, at least. So there was a lot of hopefulness going into the last session. Midway through session, a group of socially conservative legislators basically in committee passed a very watered-down version of the bill, one that was so watered-down, in fact, that the original sponsor and the advocates could no longer support it because they said it would have done more harm than good. So we ended session with really no movement on this issue. Several months later, Governor Gary Herbert asked state regulators to take matters into their own hands and do this administratively outside the legislature. So over the summer, they held hearings, they drafted new language. That process was also extremely complicated when the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints came out in opposition to the original draft. Finally, at long last, we heard from Governor Herbert's office that they had been able to develop some kind of consensus language, which just went into effect earlier this week.
What allowed the Church of Jesus, you know, it's an influential player in Utah. What allowed the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints to get behind this time around?
So it was kind of funny. They actually went back to the original bill that was sponsored last year. Essentially identical language. And the difference between the original drafted rule and what ended up being approved was they have a carve-out, an exemption that applies to clergy who are not working in a counseling or psychologist capacity. So it would basically mean that the rule wouldn't apply to people who are just, members of the clergy interacting with people.
Okay. I mean, does that, in practice, does that do anything?
From what I heard from church officials, there was some concern that, say, you're a religious leader who's also a licensed therapist, but you're talking to a young person in your capacity as a religious leader and not as a therapist. There was some concern that in that type of situation, you could have your professional license taken away from you.
Okay. I actually saw on Equality Utah, the leader of Equality Utah, Troy Williams, on his Facebook page, he addressed this and said that the exemption for clergy is just basically how it works, that the state doesn't really get to regulate clergy all that much, though there's a bill at this upcoming session that might test that. And the governor's in favor of this. Bethany said that he would try and thwart any attempts to change this bill,
yes,
this law.
So since this was passed as a rule, an administrative rule under the executive branch, the legislature has not signed off on it. And so there is some concern and, even some chatter that some of these conservative lawmakers will try to go back and pass some legislation to sort of change or roll back the rule, the ban that just went into effect. Governor Gary Herbert, as you said, he his spokesperson told me that he would not be supportive of any of these attempts. And I also was able to reach a representative for the Senate president who expressed support for where we ended up. So it sounds like, the bulk of the support is behind the ban that went into effect.
Okay. There was also the idea that this is serving as a model for other conservative states that maybe haven't passed this ban. This came from a University of Utah law professor in your article. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. So Clifford Roski worked closely with Equality Utah on the language of this ban. And Utah is the 19th state so far to enact a conversion therapy ban like this. It's the most conservative state so far to do so. So Clifford Roski said he's been fielding calls from, states like Nebraska and Iowa just to talk to him about the language that Utah settled on, and he felt like it was going to be some sort of a model to show that one of these types of bans are more about safety and mental health and less about some sort of partisan bickering.
And the safety and mental health part of this plays into, Equality Utah, the organization that advocated for this, they say that the ban will positively impact the lives of people and prevent even suicides.
Yeah, that was one of the big impetuses behind this change, is the high rate of youth suicide in this state and the feeling that, that perhaps this could make a difference in addressing that concern. Conversion therapy has been tied to higher rates of depression and suicidality among young people. So they're hoping that this will really save lives.
We're running low on time here, and I want to bring George in. But first, I want to ask, you talked about chatter, among lawmakers potentially or are out there in the ether having to do with an attempt to try and change this legislation. Who actually opposes this legislation or this rule, this administrative rule?
The most vocal opponent would be Gail Ruzicko with the Utah Eagle Forum. And so I spoke with her about what she's been hearing. She said that any discussion about potential changes is in very early phases, and so she didn't have any, you know, names of specific lawmakers to share. But I will say that the watered-down version of the legislation that, you know, kind of led to the collapse of this last session focused on specific aversion techniques like shocking people as a form of conversion therapy, or making someone nauseous as inducing sort of a physical response. And advocates say that's really not an appropriate ban, because that's not what most conversion therapy looks like
these days. It's so specific to ban that.
It's so specific. Yeah, it wouldn't really do anything, because those are pretty much outdated practices anyway.
George Pyle, we've got this conversion therapy ban that is now in effect in Utah. Dare I say the phrase, the Utah way? You know, is this...
You can say that. I mean, we blunder around a long time, and we wind up somehow doing the right thing. I mean, I give Gary Herbert grief sometimes for not having any guts, but the man apparently does have a heart on questions like this, on questions about involving immigrants and refugees. He does really seem to care about things like this, and it was really a little bit more politically savvy of him than maybe I would have given him credit for, that when it died in the legislature, it was the governor who said, okay, let's go this way. Let's go to the professional licensing agency that sort of works for me and have them do it. And it worked, and now even if the legislature comes back and says, okay, these really nasty practices over here, we've banned those by law, okay, they weren't doing those things anyway. So it makes them feel better, and they can get on with it. It's just a matter of some people realizing that another person's sex, gender identification, all these things. I can't keep all up with all these terminologies. Unless you're planning to sleep with that person, it makes no difference, and you should just leave people alone.
Okay. George Pyle, editorial page editor, columnist with the Salt Lake Tribune. We are just very soon going to have to turn to our underplayed stories of the week, but I wanted to try and squeeze in one more story. We won't be able to do it justice, Bethany, that you covered this past week, which is the headline in the Tribune was, a Utah lawmaker says the state should support Native American mascots. This is a resolution by a lawmaker from Cedar City that he wants to see passed at this upcoming session. What's it all about?
This lawmaker says that he introduced the resolution as a result of the debate last year over Cedar High's mascot, which is the Red Men. School board in that county ultimately decided to get rid of the mascot after, you know, listening to the community, which was very divided on the subject. But there were a lot of folks who felt offended by it, that it was a stereotypical portrayal of Native Americans, that it was hurtful. This representative has another opinion on it. He thinks that communities should be encouraged to retain their mascots. So that's basically what this resolution would do, discourage schools or other institutions from removing, you know, Native American symbols, mascots, names from their teams or whatnot, and only do so if they determine that there's consensus among effective American Indian groups. And it's kind of vague as to what exactly that means.
Speaking of American Indian groups, there was one person who was vehemently opposed to this resolution. Again, a resolution is sort of a message. It doesn't have any teeth. It doesn't mean that you have to behave a certain way. It's a message from the state to, well, the rest of to the state, to its people. But you found somebody who was adamantly opposed to this.
Darren Perry, who is a Shoshone leader here in the state, said that it was really an uncalled for type of resolution and very much disagreed with the state taking a position on what really he says are fundamentally local decisions, that local school boards and counties should be able to determine what happens in these situations.
I'm really sorry that we're going to have to leave it there, because it is a big story. You can check it out at sltrib.com and learn more about the resolution that this representative has filed. Let's turn now to our final segment, the underplayed stories of the week. And George Pyle, we will start with you.
Well, it's only underplayed because it's brand new, but this is something you should take a look at in case you missed it. Catholic Social Services is pulling out of the new homeless service center arrangement. They said that it just didn't seem to fit what they thought were their priorities and their budget needs. This has been rumored for a while. This is another indication that maybe this whole new system is not very well thought through, is not very well funded, is probably the biggest thing. And that, you know, this is, like I say, we solved homelessness. We like doing it so much, we're going to do it again. And now it looks like we're going to have to do it a third time.
Well, we don't know who's going to run this center now.
No, they're going to be looking for a service provider.
Okay. Bethany Rogers, your pick for underplayed story.
Yeah, I just wanted to draw attention to Sean Means's really handy survival guide for the Sundance Film Festival. He covers everything from transportation to how much water you should drink to getting showing up places on time. I thought it was very useful.
All right, check that out as well. I'm going to go with the Tribune's Tony Semerad report. This one, and my underplayed story starts with a quote from his story. It's a quote that I'm going to read verbatim. Great cities aren't created by chain restaurants and retailers and cookie-cutter shops and services. The unique indigenous businesses that come out of nowhere are what make great cities interesting in terms of art and culture. And I think bookstores are part of that fabric. That quote was by Ken Sanders, who runs Ken Sanders Rare Books, a neighbor of KCBW's here, just a couple blocks away from Library Square. And it turns out that Ken Sanders Bookstore may have to close up shop next year, the Tribune reports, because the place where his business is located is slated for redevelopment, and also because downtown is just getting too expensive for him and he doesn't want to be anywhere else. Check that out, and you can read the full article and lament the changing downtown if you want at sltrib.com. You can also find all of the stories that we've been talking about today. George Pyle and Bethany Rogers, thanks so much for joining me on Behind the Headlines today.
Thank you.
Behind the Headlines is a co-production of KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune and is heard across the state on Utah Public Radio. Thanks as always to our operations director, Jesse Ellis, and to producer Tim Pierce, and to the Utah Public Radio team in Logan. You can find podcasts of this and all of our local programs at kcpw.org. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks again for joining us, and we'll see you again next week.